Welcome to Action Potential. I'm Sahan Ranamukharaji. Our goal is to propagate ideas that can revolutionize medical care delivery. Join us as we amplify the voices of thought leaders, explore remote physiological monitoring, and ignite a wave of change. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to our podcast, Action Potential, talking about all things the future of remote physiological monitoring. I'm so happy to welcome Lillian Okwonkwo to our podcast. Lillian is the Senior Director of Hospital Services at Strive Health. Lillian, thank you very much for being here with us. Tell our audience a little bit about you, Lillian.
Thank you, Sahan. It's such a pleasure to be here. I think I was looking forward to this discussion so much because it's a much needed conversation for us to have. My name is Lillian Okwonkwo, and I'd like to talk about myself as being a dedicated and experienced healthcare professional with a passion for driving positive change and improving our patient outcomes, right? With a decade of progressive leadership and experience in healthcare settings and a strong foundation in nursing leadership, I've got experience in regulatory compliance, revenue management, and business development. Even though I have this background, I think I've never left my core of making sure that we provide high quality patient outcomes.
So Lillian, in your work, you've told us one of the interesting things that we see is that you've spent so much time in the acute care setting. You see these patients probably at what you call a vulnerable time. Can you tell us a little bit about that? You must see patients across the entire spectrum of chronic kidney disease, from earlier stage in CKDs to, you know, people who are maybe on the verge of dialysis but not quite there yet, and then all people who have end stage kidney disease. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience is like?
Sure. Just like you rightly mentioned, I think I come in at that very sweet spot where most patients I would like to consider are vulnerable and most times are willing to listen, because the question in their minds at that point are, how did I get here? Or they've been told that they had this disease but decided to dig their heads in the sand and not really take education in, and all of a sudden have crashed into the hospital. The thing with this experience is it can sometimes be very, very breathtaking for the patient because it's a near-death experience. And they, for the most part, if they've been in denial, have now come to realize and accept that this may just be a way of life for them. So our education sometimes ranges differently and a different spectrum at which we see our patients. I think research has shown that when we educate our patients, we see better outcomes. And most times with a lot of the ups and the downs that happen in the hospital setting, right, the going and the comings of different faces, they are usually appreciated when a familiar face comes in and is able to talk to them about a disease process. And they understand, because the process is really spoken at a language that they understand. The other piece that we have that plays to our advantage within the acute care setting is time. So we know that an average time a patient is admitted in the hospital is between 7 to 10 days. So depending on whatever spectrum and how long the patient waited before coming into the hospital, or if they are newly diagnosed, right? So we can come in the first day and, you know, it's a grief cycle. The patient may not want to listen the first day. We come in the second day, they don't want to listen. And then all of a sudden, the third day, they're open and they're willing, because now they've had the time to digest the fact that they have this disease. They're coming to terms. And coming to terms means they're willing to take whatever help that is available. I think the knee-jerk instinct is there a cure? And as much as we want to say yes, because I'm hoping that technology provides us that situation down the line, we start to provide them what the disease is about, what treatment modalities that we have for them. They understand it. And this even goes for CKD patients. about their diet, right? What do you eat? How do you make sure that your disease doesn't go any further than it is right now? How do we slow the disease down? And look, if you're in dialysis, to have you understand that it's not the end of the world. Now the diet is going to be more restricted. I get it. But you have the disease, it doesn't have you. And we give them and arm them with the tools to go out into the dialysis centers, make sure that they understand how important the treatment is to them. And that we've seen over time has encouraged compliance amongst our patients. So I think it would really come in where I sit rather is in that very sweet spot where patients are most likely to listen to them because, again, like I said, we've got time on our hands and we want to make sure that the patients understand that disease process.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful point. We often hear that to your point, time is so important because the more times you can start to get your face in front of the patients and have small interactions, the more credibility you get to build. So
that's right.
It's a very interesting point you mentioned that you can establish trust before they leave the hospital. If you got 7 to 10 days, in length of stay or even shorter, but it's more time than someone would have visiting a clinician's office and, getting FaceTime.
So that's correct. In addition to what I just said, the other piece that I would like to talk about is the transition of patients into their value-based programs. Again, continuation of education, which we know is, again, very important to patients understanding this disease process, making sure that they know how to eat. So that sweet transition that we create once a patient has been discharged into their value-based programs enables continuity of care, which is, again, paramount to our patient outcomes, right? So we create that space for us, and we found that it's been very helpful.
Lillian, you mentioned diet a number of times as a big thing. You talked about technologies. I assume in the kidney care space, historically, it's mostly been around therapies, medications, and now there are better options for, in-home dialysis. I want to touch on a lot of those. But you mentioned earlier that you see patients across CKD3 all the way to ESRD. And I assume a lot of the patients that you do see in the acute care setting, which is, as you called it, a sweet spot in a way, are first time experiencing that they suddenly have detrimental chronic kidney disease or they're facing dialysis. Is that true? And if so, what brings them to the acute care setting to begin with that makes them realize, oh, I need to start paying attention?
Yeah, so unfortunately, as much as I'd like to tell you that most of the patients that we see are just hearing it for the first time, it is CKD, so it is progressive. Most times, that's not the first time they're hearing. And most times, there are other comorbids that have been told that would lead to CKD. So your diabetes, your hypertension that is not properly managed. And there are patients that we've seen that have come in for other diseases, but ended up having AKI, acute renal injury, while in the hospital. So it's what I'm trying to say is it's a different array of patients that we see in the hospital. For the newer patients, it's brand new to them. This whole process reeks of fear, right? So our goal is to let them know what it's about. And that if it's an AKI, well, recovery is possible. And if it's CKD, and that has progressed to ESKD, because at that point, they would be crashing into the hospital, you would need to go on dialysis. And I think that's one of the very beautiful things that we're seeing with a lot of our value-based programs, right? That they're looking to start reducing the amount of crashes that we have when patients come into the hospital because they've been told that they have this disease. They've been told that they have comorbids that would lead to this disease. But some of them, maybe as a coping mechanism, have just chosen not to deal with it or compliance has just been a thing with them. And medications are not being taken, and the disease has just progressed to the point where they now need dialysis.
Right. Lillian, if I were to kind of pick an example disease state, and I don't want to overly generalize, but let's say a patient who has diabetes and hypertension, to your point, they have these comorbidities, almost guaranteed you're going to end up in chronic kidney disease at some stage or the other. Let's hypothesize here that patient has had some kind of an event that's led them to the hospital. They realize they're now at a CKD5. What's that patient's journey, today with and maybe without the value-based programs? Like, let's just kind of walk through it without, before, let's say 10 years ago, what would have happened to that patient?
Yeah. So 10 years ago, the patient would have ended up crashing with very bad labs, right? Because clearly there were no outpatient, not enough outpatient programs that helped monitor patients or monitor the disease states, right? So this patient would have ended up in the hospital, were probably running around to get a dialysis nurse to come dialyze these patients because the creatinine is up, the potassium is up, and this patient is close to having all systems shut down. Fast forward to now, we're having better stats, what I'd like to call better stats, or sometimes planned stats, right? And some doctors feel comfortable with starting their patients in the hospital. That's not considered a crash. That's actually a planned stat. That's what we want. But this is because we're now having value-based programs that are working in close tandem with physicians and are making sure that this disease process is monitored closely. And it doesn't necessarily, all the doctor has to do is, this patient is a kidney patient, right? And the value-based programs get on the patient and they create care coordination for the patient. They have the patient follow up on doctor's visits. They have the patient follow up on maybe monthly lab visits to make sure that the labs are being monitored closely to avoid a crash in the hospital. And then we still have our patients who end up crashing into the hospital and for whatever reason it is, right? I think this is where in the acute space, we again come in and make sure that we ease the understanding of that patient, of the education to that patient, and make sure that we do transition this patient after whatever treatment that we have has been done to that patient, that this patient is transitioned out with the help of the physician to a value-based program so that we start to dial back on our readmission rates, because currently I think we're running at 30%, right? 30% for ESKD, and this is as a nation.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, 10 years ago, this patient would have crashed into dialysis. What's the cost that you know associated with crash dialysis in the first year? It's some ridiculous number, isn't it?
Oh my God. So we're talking about crashes. I think I was looking at the number recently, recent research, and it said that it cost about 100,000 or slightly over 100,000, depending on whatever payer it is, right? But an average of 100,000 per crash, right? And assuming there wasn't any education for this patient, most likely we are probably going to see a readmission of this patient back into the hospital. The studies actually show that it's 3 to 4 times a year for a patient, or even within the first 90 days. But what we're seeing is, because there's an easier transition out, right, to the value-based programs, we're seeing a cutback on, or a reduction on, the readmission rate to these patients, because there is proper monitoring once the patient leaves. And this is because the value-based programs are there. They are coordinating and caring for the patient once the patient leaves the hospital. That particular part where we are able to feedback that loop and close up the loop on the patient, making sure that we communicate with either the transitional care unit or even the value-based programs as a whole, has been very, very helpful, because before now, what we would see we would discharge the patient, and whatever happened to the patient after then, we wouldn't know, right?
They're on their own, yeah.
They're on their own, and no education has been given. And so most likely, they're going back, they're doing the same things that they've done before. And sometimes even for lack of understanding the disease process, will come right back into the hospital for something that could have been solved by the outpatient dialysis or even the value-based program.
Right. So it's not always the case that the value-based program would say, hey, you need to start dialysis. I'm assuming in a lot of cases with, you know, CKD 3 to 5 patients, they probably still have a little bit more room to go with their existing kidneys. But for the ones that actually do need dialysis instead of a crash dialysis and 3 to 4 readmissions, you're actually getting them on planned dialysis.
Right.
And maybe you want to, you know, if they have readmissions, based on what you're saying, Lillian, even if they have readmissions, it probably just strengthens your relationship with the patients, which makes them believe more in, you know, the support that they have. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, that is absolutely correct.
So how much do you think each readmission costs? You mentioned average length of stay for a hospital is 7 to 10 days. That must be at least $20,000 or so in the U.S., isn't it?
So again, another research that was shown showed an average of about $40,000 for a patient who is on dialysis. At least this is what is being sent out to payers, right? A night.
Yeah.
What it costs an ESKD patient a night. And can you imagine having staying 7 to 10 days?
Sorry, how much?
It costs about $30,000 to $40,000 a night for an ESKD patient to stay in a hospital. So can you then imagine if a patient had to stay 7 to 10 days and having 3 to 4 readmissions a year?
$400,000 an admission? So clearly my math was wrong. That is crazy numbers.
That is crazy numbers. And this is why I still believe that we have a lot to do in this space, right? Because these financial, when you look at these financial numbers, I think we could do better. Our patient outcomes will reflect that we could do better. And yeah. It's one thing when we look at the money, but we also know that the healthcare outcomes affect the financial piece directly. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So is for value-based programs, is the sweet spot the planned dialysis to start off because of the high number of readmission rates? And then think about moving upstream in CKD where the population grows to a bigger N?
Yeah. So I think for the patients, right, a planned stat is absolutely necessary. When a patient crashes into the hospital, depending on when they crash, it could either be a life or death situation. So it's almost like, why do we have to wait to get to that point when we can have optimal starts for a patient? Mm-hmm. We can have a patient go into peritoneal dialysis, or even better still, home hemo. I just have a preference for home hemo. So I'm just going to be partial about that. But expose them to other modalities. Have the patient participate and be part of their care. That is the one thing that we have on our side when we do see CKD patients, which is why a lot of education, a lot of care coordination goes into the care of a CKD patient, right? But when a patient crashes into the hospital, we are taking that power away from them. And until they've been stabilized, they're not part of the care, because we're calling the shots as healthcare professionals. We're making sure that they're safe. We're making sure that they're dialyzed. We're not giving them the option of having, a fistula or peritoneal access. We're just putting that IJ in, hoping and making sure that, look, we just want to make sure that we get this patient dialyzed in a safe and effective manner before we can get them released. Yeah.
You want to make sure that they're safe before they and stable before they can explore those
Absolutely.
options. That makes sense. You mentioned earlier, Lillian, depending on the stage at which the patient is in the disease progression, earlier stages of CKD versus, very last minutes of their kidney life and moving into dialysis. You mentioned the dietary plans will be very different. They might be able to eat certain things, not others. There's a whole host of medications available.
Yes.
How 10 years ago versus now, how are you thinking about those diet and medications piece differently?
So it's always funny when you see a CKD patient and you tell them, well, you can have this or you can have that. And I think this, come to think of it, actually goes through ESRD, right? And you tell them you can have a food that you can have any food that has lots of potassium. They don't know what that looks like. You can't have any food that has lots of phosphorus. They don't know what that looks like. And if they do ask, we have this list of foods, right, that is everyday staple in our diet, right? And so the patient turns around and says to you, well, then what can I eat? Well, unfortunately, I'm also not a dietitian. I do know that this is the list of foods that you're not supposed to eat. And we tell them what we want to tell them and we walk away. It's changing. I think that's the piece that I love, right? The value-based care space is creating a space where we have registered dietitians, right? Which I love to work hand in hand with. We're having case managers who are care coordinating for our patients, right? But like you rightly said, dietitians, we have nurses who are going over the medications of the patients because say depending on if it's a CKD or ESRD patient, the patient may or may not be on a medication that is causing that could cause a spike in potassium. So again, I think the value-based care space has allowed for proper education and proper coordination among the dietitians, among clinicians to work hand in hand and make sure that for CKD patients, that we create a space that helps reduce the progression of the disease, right? And this is by, again, medication reconciliation, by having a registered dietitian go over what they eat, maybe even work with what they eat, right? But still, again, reducing that progression. And with ESKD patients, making sure that even if they do eat it, look, guys, you're well educated that this would increase your potassium or your phosphorus, and these are the results that you'll see, right? And if you do start to see these results, know to call the, come back into the hospital or call your dialysis centers to take care of it.
I can totally understand that. And to your earlier point, Lillian, around food choices, I think one thing we hear from a lot of patients that we work with in the remote physiological monitoring space, which is, what we're focused on, most of the healthy foods we're told to eat all our lives have a lot of these things, right? So it's not, and as someone who I often consider myself someone who lives to eat as opposed to eats to live, I find it would be extremely difficult without the support of dietitians to figure out how to still how to still enjoy the little things in life that food brings. Just lots of cultural aspects of how we interact with families and conduct our day-to-day life that surrounds food. So I'm glad to hear that that's one of the big areas of focus for value-based provider groups.
Yes, think about it. I mean, if you really think about it, we've been told all our lives that green leafy vegetables are part of a good, healthy meal, right? So
All the
all
fruits you can get,
anything
right?
your vegetables, but guess what they're high in as well, right? Potassium. And we don't want our patient's potassium to go high because those are things that make the disease process progress faster.
Lillian, so you talked about in the value-based efforts, there's a lot of interesting education and care coordination upsides you've seen so far. in the acute care setting where you get to spend an enormous amount of time, relatively speaking, with the patients and getting them to understand that you're on their side and you have a team of coordinated and well-educated clinicians that are willing to help. Clearly, this must have led to much better engagement with the patients and build trust, and allowed you to do a lot more in transitioning from the acute care setting to home-based settings with the patients, as opposed to 10 years ago when the patients would get discharged and they're on their own and they would. I'm really glad to have kind of mapped that out with you. Now, when we think about the future of, you know, how technology can help, not just with therapies, but particularly because our podcast's interest is in remote physiological monitoring. You've talked about creatinine, you've talked about potassium increases, you've talked about phosphorus. What do you see as the future? What are some of the things that really excites you that would enable you to make these transitions so much better?
You know, I think remote monitoring is going to be very helpful across the board, and this includes even when a patient does get a transplant, which we consider is the best possible treatment that we could give a patient, right? It's not a cure, it's a treatment. So, because we know that in the first couple of days of a transplant, a patient is still very acute and anything can happen. Well, we also know on the other spectrum of things, on the CKD side of things, right, that a patient is not being monitored unless a patient is starting to get closer and closer to ESRD. They're probably being monitored once a month, right, or depending on the stage, once in 3 months. And as they start to progress, maybe that starts to get to every month. But do we really have to wait for that? Right? Do we really have to wait? It would be lovely if we got something in technology that would give us on the spot confirmation for what it is that we need on patient. And
What is it that you mostly need on patients?
it like I, you call it right. So creatinine, right? Oh, I mean, I haven't heard about any other so creatinine, EGFR, potassium, because you know that we have to keep our heart beating, and hemoglobin. I think those are the four major things. When it comes to phosphate, it's more of okay, what you eat, how you eat it, how you take your binders, and we do have medicine for that. But when it comes to the four, with the last two that I just mentioned, hemoglobin and potassium in mind, these are two vital components that when you're looking at a patient who's progressing, typically they're not going to be making as much hemoglobin anymore. And we know that a low hemoglobin means low oxygen to the body, and that can have a patient crash into the hospital. Well, I can say the same thing as well for potassium, because if a potassium is not properly taken care of, a patient could be susceptible to a heart attack, or vice versa, the other way, depending on what diuretic a patient is. So we need on-hand monitoring or remote monitoring that would help us monitor a patient every day, to help manage the disease closely and properly, instead of having to rely on monthly labs that may or may not be accurate at the time when we're looking at the patient to react to it. I always like to follow the journey of an ESKD patient, or potassium in an ESKD patient. And the best story I always like to tell is, imagine a patient coming in, an MWF patient. So a patient is scheduled for dialysis, MWF, coming in on a Monday after having a good time over the weekend, right? They come in on Monday and you take their blood, right? That is when we test for CNPs and stuff like that. And potassium is part of it. And then the patient dialyzes with a regular 2K. A 2K bath, which would be your 2K potassium, right? Most likely. And then what happens is I come and I round on a Wednesday, right? maybe at 9:10, but this patient was really in the morning. So at this time, this patient has dialyzed 2 times in a row at 2K. I'm not exactly sure what I'm really looking at, because at this point, if the result comes out and the patient has a 6.5 potassium, what exactly am I reacting to? Am I reacting to today's potassium after 2 dialysis treatments at the 2K bath? Or am I reacting to Monday's draw, right? Pre-dialysis? It gets a bit confusing at that point, right? And again, that keeps us very reacting in the healthcare.
Yeah, and in a space where I suppose now in the value-based care realm, you're trying to do everything you can to reduce readmissions into the hospital, as you mentioned, keeping people managed by more frequent measurements would allow you to ensure that you're not getting patients into you're avoiding situations that you can simply by managing them better.
That's correct.
Lillian, this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm really glad we had a chance to speak about this. Having done all this work for the past, you know, over a decade now in this space, and now you're with Strive and other programs you've been involved in, you've been able to kind of see the journey unfold in the kidney care space. What's the outcome that you aspire for? If you had a magic wand, instead of, don't say, you know, if I get a wish, I'd love to have 3 wishes. none of that. What is it that you're working towards? What's the ideal outcome?
I have to, first and foremost, right, I have to really commend the folks that have created, we just had a recent transplant in the US, right? That was genetically modified, a pig's kidney that was genetically
modified. Yeah, I saw that one.
Right. And we've got to say that that's a win in our space, right? Because this has been tried in other fields before, right? And even though it's a failure, it's not a failure. I think you live to learn, right? And for the first time, that was attempted in our field. So I think I have a lot of hope, and I know that I don't want to have wishes that are white horses. But I would ask that we continue to strive and that we continue to make leaps and bounds in creating technologies that would help us. This is a disease that everyone in 3 to 4 people will have. That's a huge number. Do you know how much we are in America?
Or globally. Scared the crap out of me.
Right. And you're thinking about the 2 diseases that affect a lot of people, diabetes and hypertension, right? If it's not genetically gotten, you get it by way of life. So either way, you're predisposed to it. So I think if you ask me for a wish that we do get a solution, a permanent solution for it, but in the absence of that, I like that we're starting to make leaps and bounds and we're trying new things. I would like to see new ways of testing new things, right, to better manage a patient closely. But
that's
I think we could ask me that question right before the transplant happened, I would have had a different answer, but I'd like that we're pushing the boundaries on that, because that would make a huge difference for us.
Yeah. And for patients. Lillian, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining our podcast.
Thank you.
We look forward to many more conversations in the future.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Okay.